Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have another good comment to read, and this is actually from a friend down in Australia. I should say one of JBL's listening friends, and she was so excited by her writing her first comment. Now she's writing again. She says, "Dear JBL, I just had to write again and tell you what's happened since my last comment last week. I am so excited. After hearing the teens, I decided if Jude could read 37 books on his schedule, I certainly can, and I need to go get them, not wait for them to come to me." And so I think she's on a limited income, and she kind of waits till kind of books just kind of fall in her lap. Well, I can understand that, but she has a plan now. She goes on to say, "Also, Mr. Fleury admonished us to set goals on reading, so I started and resolved to read Napoleon and the Churchill books, even though politics seems to be just beyond me to understand fully." And so what she's referring to is Mr. Stephen Fleury does have a book club going for the students in Edstone, and I think what he's been doing is writing up some of his lectures and then making them available on the trumpet.com website. And I know they are reading Napoleon the Great right now. And so I think I certainly want to dig into that book sometime. But we have other things to do here on JBL, like read Hero by Michael Korda. So anyway, what she decided to do is really exciting. She says, "So I went and joined the local library. They didn't have any of the autobiographies I wanted, but Napoleon was on loan, so I put a hold on that. So I decided to have a look in the history and biography section, and after some looking, found what I thought may be interesting, Churchill and the Jews by Martin Gilbert." And that is a really good book. "I had always wondered why the Jews were persecuted so much in Europe and Russia. I know Satan is behind it all, but what mechanism did he bring so much hatred? And what I found is astonishing. Satan used the Jews against themselves through the Bolsheviks. These Russian Jews who had denounced their faith and become atheists started communism. Of course, there is more to it, but I love this quote of Churchill. This was Bolshevism. It would almost seem as if the gospel of Christ and the gospel of the Antichrist were designed to originate among the same people, and that the mystic and mysterious race had been chosen for the supreme manifestations, both divine and diabolical." And that's the end of the quote from Winston Churchill. So it says, "My point in all of this is I now have understanding of Bolshevism, where it started, how it impacted the time then, and now as we see communism, socialism growing huge in the Western nations, I am seeing a bigger picture than I ever have had, and that is just since Thursday. Imagine what I will understand next week, and all from reading a book that once I thought I would never have looked at twice. Thank you, Mr. Leap. Thank you, Mr. Stephen Fleury, and especially Jude and all the teens. I am 50 years old and feel like I'm just starting my education." So that is from the great nation of Australia. So thank you for those comments. Well, today what I want to do is I just want to continue my discussion, or I should say maybe my introduction of the life of T.E. Lawrence. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we obviously can learn from him. But here's why I want everyone to read this book. And it's really a study of heroism. And if you want to be a hero, or if I want to be a hero, why, this is a great book to read. And I think in the long run, you know, when it's all said and done about me and my life, I would like to be seen as somebody's hero, you know. So anyway, I think there are some many, many lessons that we could learn from him. Now, I did go and I borrowed some things from the Britannica Online. So you know, there's some good places to get some maybe some quick research done. But obviously, let's talk a little bit about the beginning of his life. And again, it's not the best beginning. And of course, he's known, his full name is Thomas Edward Lawrence. He did not like to go by Thomas Edward. He always liked to go by T.E. A lot of people know him as Lawrence of Arabia. And then later in his life, he changed his name to T.E. Shaw. And we'll talk about why he did that. And I think it just shows he was searching for anonymity. He didn't want to be known, but he still wanted to be involved in a lot of things. So he was born in August 16th, 1888. And so, that's around the same time, I think Herbert Armstrong was born in July of 1889. Now, I could be wrong about that. So these two men are from that same era. And certainly, I think all of us that are in the Philadelphia Church of God, all of us here associated with the college, all of us that are associated with Trumpet.com and the Trumpet, we all see, Herbert Armstrong as our hero. And, there was a man that got a lot done. And it seems like men from that time period really knew how to go after things and really get into what was necessary. And, Mr. Armstrong died, some 30-some years ago. But he is still very much remembered. And he really set the pace for many things in terms of, religious broadcasting and religious publication. And, he developed Ambassador College, which was just stunning in this world. And, of course, that's all been destroyed now by the people that he left in charge. And that's a really sad state of affairs. But at least those of us in, little Philadelphia, we're still carrying on with his work. So, he was born August 16th, 1888. He died May 19th, 1935. So, he was still, he wasn't that old when he died. And actually, when he died of a kind of a strange motorcycle accident. But he was actually born Welsh. He was born in Wales, and then he died in England. And so, his life, went through a lot of changes. But he's really known as a British archaeological scholar. And, he was brilliant at archaeology. He's also known as a military strategist. He's best known in terms of being an author for writing the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Now, he also, after his death, there was another book of his published. It was called Crusader Castles, and that was a work that he had done when he was at Oxford as an archaeologist, and essentially when he went to Oxford, he was studying the Crusader Castles in France, and he studied the Crusader Castles in Syria and Palestine. And so, this was his thesis on studying those castles. And again, that book is called Crusader Castles, and that was published posthumously. But let's talk about his early life now. It says, Lawrence was the son of Sir Thomas Chapman and Sarah Maiden. Now, this is where, his life really, wasn't the best, Sarah Maiden was the governess for his father's daughters. And so, this happened with the aristocratic people at that time. Sir Thomas Chapman left his wife, ran away with his daughter's governess, and then he had five sons. And so this really kind of bothered Lawrence all of his life. He and his father were not married. His father and his mother were not married. But like I said, they had he had five sons, and in that situation, there's a lot of pressure put on children when your parents are not married. And can you imagine what it was like in the late 1800s to have that happening? Even today, there's so many people go out there and they cohabit and they have children, and it's really hard on the children. You know, they know their parents aren't married, and it just puts them in a different category than maybe, let's say, the children they go to school with that their parents are married. It's just wrong. So anyway, the couple, they were known as Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence, but again, that was just a sham. Anyway, the family did settle in Oxford, and I think that maybe that's one of the reasons why he preferred his initials to the names. Maybe he didn't want to be known, or maybe he wanted to just be away from, you know, all the pressure of his father and his mother's family life. But he did go to high school. He went to Jesus College. I'm sure I don't really understand. Let's say public education in England. So I'm not sure if that was a preparatory school. But when he was at Jesus College, medieval military architecture was his first interest. And he really pursued it, and he loved it. And he studied it. And from doing that, he was able to get this traveling fellowship from Magdalen College, and that's when he was able to have all of his expenses paid to go and help excavate the Hittite settlement at Carchemish on the Euphrates. So he worked there from 1911 to 1914, and he was under Hogarth, the famous archaeologist Hogarth, and he was under Sir Leonard Woolley. And anybody in the archaeological world knows who those two men are. And then when he wasn't digging, he used his free time to travel on his own. He got to know the language in the Middle East. He got to know the people. And early in 1914, he and Woolley and Captain S.F. Newcomb explored the northern Sinai on the Turkish frontier east of the Suez. And so essentially what he was doing, he was getting a lot of preparation or a lot of experience in those areas, and especially the geography of the areas. Now, what the Britannica Online says, supposedly this was a scientific expedition, but in fact it was sponsored by the Palestine Exploration Fund, and it was really more about map making, and they were really trying to do the map making from the Gaza to the Aqaba. And eventually this became very, very important for the war, World War One. And again, a lot of people don't understand that, you know, World War One was also fought in the Middle East. And the way that happened, if you understand a little bit of the history, and I understand it on a, let's say, maybe a very surface level, is if you remember the Turks ruling the Ottoman Empire, or what was left of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, at one time, the Ottoman Empire stretched all the way to Vienna and included most of southwestern Europe. And so at one point, the Ottoman Empire was almost considered European as well. But here's the point. The month that the war began, Lawrence became a civilian employee of the map department of the War Office in London. So you can see that all these things that he was doing as an archaeologist ended up being great for British intelligence. And so essentially what this War Office in London charged Lawrence with doing was making useful maps of the Sinai. And by December of 1914, he was made a lieutenant in Cairo. Now, the thing is essentially what Lawrence began to do then, because he was, let's say, in intelligence and in British intelligence, he then became an expert on Arab affairs. And he was able to travel into Turkish-held Arab lands. This was just a great opportunity for him. And, you know, he spent more than a year there. And essentially, if you look at the way some of the people describe him, it's kind of like he disappeared into the desert. And then he came out like this hero. And so it is, you know, really, really kind of fascinating. And we're going to get more into more details, you know, with this. But he really saw the needs of the Arabic peoples. And remember now, they had been under, you know, the rule of the Ottoman Turks. And so you know, he got in there and joined with them and began to advise them on how they could, well, rebel against, you know, the Ottoman Empire. And remember now, the Ottoman Empire had already joined with Germany. And so they joined with Germany against Russia and against England. And so essentially, what Lawrence was doing is he was fighting for England. And so it's not that he just wanted to, you know, just inspire rebellion. He was help building an army that they could take over, you know, against the Turks. And it's really amazing. When he came back, I guess he came back out of the desert. He came back into Cairo in November, and Lawrence, it says here in the Britannic Online that Lawrence urges superiors to abet the efforts at rebellion with arms and gold, and to make use of the dissident sheikhs by meshing their aspirations for independence with a general military strategy. And then he rejoined Faisal's army as a political and liaison officer. And so he became very valuable, not only to the British, but he became very valuable to the Arabic peoples, and actually, you know, loved them, and, really began to sympathize with them. So, but this is where he also taught them guerrilla, guerrilla tactics. So he essentially, which was very, very rare, is the Arabs, like, saw him as one of them. And so that's really kind of fascinating. And again, we're going to get into this more in the book. So I don't want to get too much into this. But again, he spent a lot of time really trying to help the Arabic nations organize. And I think anybody that has any inkling of what's going on in the Middle East, you know, to get the Arabic peoples to organize and stay organized and stay loyal to each other is you know, quite a task. And so in some ways, here the Britannica says, by the time this motley Arab army reached Damascus in October 1918, Lawrence was physically and emotionally exhausted, having forced his body and spirit to the breaking point too often. He had been wounded numerous times, captured and tortured, had endured extremities of hunger, weather, and disease, and had been driven by military necessity to commit atrocities upon the enemy, and had witnessed in the chaos of Damascus the defeat of his aspirations for the Arab in the very moment of their triumph, their seeming incurable factionalism rendering them incapable of becoming a nation. And so can you imagine Lawrence was doing all this fighting to organize them, get together, get them moving, you know, helping them win against the Turks, and then because of their own weaknesses, it couldn't be pulled together. So, you know, he just became, you know, exhausted. And, of course, he experienced his own atrocities during the war and was really scarred by the way he was even caught and captured and tortured. And, you know, it really did have, you know, an effect on him. Okay, so then by the time he was 30, you know, he was a colonel. But then by the time he was 34, he was back to being a private citizen. And one of the things he did when he became a private citizen, he tried to lobby vainly, it says, for the Arab independence at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. I guess he was very dramatic. He even appeared at that conference in Arab robes. Remember, this Lawrence of Arabia was very blonde, blue-eyed, And I guess he showed up at the meeting in these Arab robes, and he had his, you know, dagger or sword at his side. And so I guess that's kind of a dramatic way to show up at a peace conference. But Peter O'Toole, there was a movie called Lawrence of Arabia. I think it was out. And I remember seeing it as an older teenager. Really didn't understand it much at that time, but I'd actually like to probably watch it again now to see. I probably could understand it a lot better. But anyway, he tried to go to work for them, and then it just didn't work out in their favor the way it should be. And so, again, we're still having trouble in the Middle East because of some of those things. But he did also become an advisor on Arab affairs, and, he actually was an advisor to Winston Churchill on Arab affairs. And if you remember back to our programs on Winston Churchill, I think I mentioned Lawrence of Arabia at that time. And the two of them worked together to really, get these nations built in the Middle East. And, of course, the Middle East, even as Mr. Armstrong said, is always going to be a powder keg and until Christ returns. And so, like I said, this is just a big swath overview for right now. And then we're going to get into more details when we get into the book by Michael Korda. Now, we have to remember that not only was he an archaeologist, a scholar, and a military strategist, a great map maker, but he also, was a great writer. And, he actually wrote poetry. He wrote The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which, like I said, I'm going to read in conjunction with Michael Korda. We're going to bring some of it into the program. And, the thing is, even George Bernard Shaw helped him edit The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And he even wrote poetry. And I think in some ways he was a little bit about like Melville. He was trying to maybe a little too poetic with Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And I think George Bernard Shaw just gave him some tips on how to make it more like a memoir and things like that. But like I said, we'll get into this some more. But the thing is that the Seven Pillars of Wisdom was he had invested a lot of money in it himself, and it really wasn't, that popular when it first came out. Then it was reissued again, kind of like maybe it took out a lot of the adjectives and the extra stuff in it, or maybe the art to it, and then it was reprinted as Revolt in the Desert. And it's just interesting that I don't think the public really liked either way. I don't think that got really a lot of acceptance at that time anyway. But now it's seen as probably one of the greatest war books on war ever. So it is kind of interesting. He took the name T.E. Shaw. Now, if you kind of look at George Bernard Shaw as a friend, and then what he did is he wanted to be more involved in military action, and so he took the name T.E. Shaw, and he became a private in the Royal Air Force. And so a lot of people accused him of being a spy, or that they were using him as a spy, but eventually he got kicked out of the Air Force as well. And so, but again, during his last years, I think he somehow got himself back in where he was back in the Royal Air Force on seaplanes. And he was not a guy that would give up, and he really wanted to be involved in things. And so, that's just the sign of a true hero, is he's not going to give up, and he didn't want to be known, and so it really is quite interesting. But then, like I said, at the end of his life, he was back in England, and he was killed in a really kind of a freak motorcycle accident. And so, obviously, that was the end to a great life. And so, we're going to be talking more about this. And essentially, what I want to do now is just encourage you to get out and buy this book and start reading it. I know it's been kind of a long time coming, but I think we've had some great series. And remember, this is our British biography series, and we have some really special things coming up, later in the spring. But we're going to really dig into this book. So that's all the time we're going to take for today's program. Now, next time, what we'll do is we'll bring the 60-plus panel in, and we're going to be talking about Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. And so there'll be a lot of discussion on these things. We'll be really excited to have James Brandon with us as well. And so what you can do is make sure you get a copy of this book. You can buy it at Amazon.com. You'll spend a little bit more money there, but you can also find a good used copy of the book at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also, as our friend in Australia did, you can check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.